Thanks very much to the organizers for inviting me and for arranging pleasant weather. What I want to talk about is DNA condensation by multivalent cations, and you learned from Andrea Liu's talk just previously why that's an interesting and challenging topic. I want to go briefly through a rather large number of topics, and what I want to do is to try, after some introduction and just a very brief review of our idea of what the theory of attraction is here, to talk about some of the experimental realities of this system. I think theoretical idealization is a good thing, and experimental reality is a good thing, and one needs a dialectic. And in a meeting like this, I think there's a danger of getting too much on one side. So I will try to do that, and I will also, the very nice discussion we had with Andrea's paper led me to think about some things. I'll try to remember to bring them up, even though I hadn't prepared to talk about them. So let me acknowledge my coworkers. Yulia Ruzina worked on a sort of a Wigner crystal idea, although we didn't call it that, for correlated fluctuations of counter ions leading to attractive forces. And Boris Shklovsky at the end will spend 20 minutes or so talking about an even simpler and more elegant approach to that, more general approach to it. We've done some single molecule optical tweezers stretching experiments under condensing conditions with Carlos Bustamante and Steve Smith at the University of Oregon. Christoph Baumann was my graduate student who worked on that. We have investigated the effects of DNA sequences, very limited way, but still, DNA is not just an undifferentiated array of phosphate charges, and it turns out that sequence has some effects. We're just beginning to explore that, but I think more will come out of it. Likewise with condensing ligands, as has been said many times, anything with a charge of plus 3 or greater will condense DNA, except if it doesn't. But there are many differences within that, and some aspects of ligand structure need further exploration. Effects of co-solvent. What happens if you try to vary the dielectric constant to test electrostatic mechanisms? Xiaochen Huang has recently done some work on this that I'll describe very briefly. And then after my half an hour, Boris Shklovsky will talk about the near crystal theory of attractive forces. So I think, even though you've seen the picture before, it deserves repeating. This is the this is the puzzle that motivates us all. How do you put Humpty Dumpty back together again? And it's not just multivalent cations. I mean, there are ATP-driven pumps and a lot of molecular motors and elaborate machinery that biology uses to do this sort of thing. If you lyse the phage more gently, what you see is that the DNA spills out of the broken capsid in a roughly toroidal shape. Probably some kind of folded toroid is how it's actually packed in there. And the thing that really made this thing accessible to physical chemists and biophysicists was the discovery by John Shellman's group 20 years ago now, that you could mimic that, the formation of those toroids, simply by adding a small amount of spermidine, a naturally occurring plus 3 polyamine, N, 3 carbons, N, 4 carbons, N, with charges, plus charges on the end. In low salt, you sprinkle a little spermidine, and the DNA spools up into toroids. Very neat. The analogy that I like to use So imagine that you scaled the thickness of DNA, 20 angstroms, up to about 1 inch, about the diameter of a garden hose. That much DNA would be several football fields long. You sprinkle some magic dust on that garden hose, and it spools up.
How much dust per foot of sand?
Okay. Yeah, one dust particle for every three phosphates. Okay, I mean actually about 90% of the charge is neutralized for DNA condensation. And in fact, this T7 is a long piece of DNA, about 40,000 base pairs. We did our initial work with T7. Other people have worked with lambda about the same length. But we have done our recent work with plasmid DNA, which is about 2,700 base pairs long. And so what you have to imagine is that you are sprinkling your magic dust on 5 or 10 or 15 garden hoses, shorter ones, that spool up into things that look like this and are morphologically indistinguishable from them. And this is the basis for the statement that was made that the size and shape of the DNA particles does not depend on the length of the DNA that goes into them. The diameter of this is about 1,000 angstrom. That's 1,000 angstrom. So these are a little bit less than 1,000 angstrom. A couple of hundred angstroms in interior size of the hole, a couple of hundred angstroms thickness of the. You've heard some eloquent descriptions of why condensed DNA is important. DNA is always condensed in biological particles, in cells or viruses, simply because it's too long to fit. It needs to be packaged in a small container. One reason is just topological, another is for protection against shear breakage or nucleases that will cleave it. Probably there are other things going on that we're only beginning to realize, like when DNA is condensed, segments that are far from each other along the chain come close to each other. That may have some regulatory implications. And the detailed geometry of how they fit may have some regulatory implications. There's a lot of interest in this now, not only because you can use this to precipitate DNA on RNA, but particularly because there's a thought that you can use condensed DNA, condensed with cationic lipids, or even just with polycations of various sorts. In gene therapy, you use this in viral vectors and in complexes with cationic liposomes, and there's a whole major biotech industry developing along these lines of thought. The ions used in our studies and in other people's studies, we've tried the divalent alkaline earth, magnesium, calcium, etc. Those do not condense DNA. The transition metals, which bind to the bases rather than to the phosphates, will condense DNA at high concentrations. And when they do, they largely denature it. So this is not what we normally call condensation. We've done a lot of Raman spectroscopy along with George Thomas at Kansas City. And what you see is very severe distortions of the DNA double helix when you work under those conditions. Putrescine, which is 1,4-diaminobutane, does not condense DNA. +3-spermidine, +4-spermine do. Hexamine cobalt, which is a spherical thing, cobalt in the middle, 6 nitrogen sticking out octahedrally, does very efficiently, about 5 times more efficiently than spermidine, which is a linear charge. We've recently played around, Hong Deng and our lab has played around with things that look sort of like this, but where the nitrogens are connected by methylene bridges, cobalt ethylene triamine, cobalt sepulchrate, which is a cryptate compound, as you might imagine. And they condense at least as efficiently, maybe even more, and in some cases with chiral selectivity, which is also interesting. Andrea showed this picture also. That's nice of her. And I want to make a couple of different points with that. First of all, not only do you get toroids, but you also, under some circumstances, get rods. Most of the time you get toroids, but sometimes you get rods. And one of the not trivial questions in this field is what determines the morphology of these particles. If it's minimum energy, what makes the energy of constant gentle bending more favorable here, but straight, no cost extension, plus then high energy ends easier there? And this may have something to do with the non-polarity of the either the solvent or the condensing agent. The other thing I want to note here is that while we've always concentrated on the isolated toroids, you notice that few of these toroids or rods are isolated. They're usually there in small clumps. And for aesthetic effect, we usually pick out the smallest clumps. But I think it's important to recognize that what we've called a secondary aggregation accompanies the primary condensation process. And while I'm not going to necessarily propose this as a mechanism for size limitation, I would point out that in our experiments, and in most the experiments of most of the groups that have worked in this field, the concentration of DNA molecules is nanomolar or less, subnanomolar. Now, that means if you have a diffusion and probably the first step is a monomolecular condensation, the first molecule collapses. And if it's a big viral molecule, maybe that's all that happens. But if you've got plasmids, you've got to recruit 10 or 20 plasmid molecules to that toroid. Now, by the sort of bimolecular kinetics that you learn in introductory PChem, you learn that the characteristic half-life for a bimolecular reaction is 1 over the rate constant times the concentration. The rate constant for a bimolecular reaction, if it's diffusion controlled, is 10 to the 9th liters per mole per second. The concentration here is 10 to the minus 9th molar, or maybe less. And I doubt that these reactions are actually quite diffusion controlled. Let's just say they're 10 or 100 times slower, which is still very fast. Rate constant of 10 to the 7th or 10 to the 8th, something like that. That means that the first steps have a half-life of 10 seconds or 100 seconds. After that's gone on for a while, you've depleted a lot of your reaction. So now you're up at 1,000 seconds and maybe 10,000 seconds. And we follow these reactions. Typically, we follow the kinetics for an hour or something like that by light scattering. But in addition to the kinetic barriers that Andrea talked about, which I think may well be there, it may be simply that you're running out of material because it is true, as somebody remarked, that if you work at higher DNA concentrations or higher condensing agent concentrations, you do get a mess. You don't get as nicely formed discrete particles, although you still do. This is still forming these is still the fastest process. But then you get secondary aggregates a large part of the time. It shows up very clearly in the light scattering and in the electron microscopy. Now, if you imagine trying to grow a toroid that's bound to something else, you can see that the something else is going to get in the way of the wrapping around. So that may, again, it's trivial, but it may be consequential. And one point that needs emphasis here is that wrapping around is indeed what happens. Even for these relatively short plasmids, about 2,700 base pairs, they wrap around a typical toroid about 5 times, or back and forth on a rod about 5 times. So if the question is asked, How does something that's binding on one side sample the total size of the particle? If it wraps around, it will do it. These kinds of thoughts, which I think were really stimulated by the discussion from Andrea's paper, leads me to wonder whether, in fact, the side-by-side aggregation of rod-like virus particles is really a good model for this, or even for this, where you're bending a stiff but still relatively flexible polymer back and forth. There may be different size-limiting factors at work. So I just suggest that you bear that in mind.
Question, yes, sir. Objection. I mean, if I look at any crystallization process and I want a nice crystal, I'd better do it slowly under control things. And the normal crystals look much more of a messy than this.
Right.
So I don't really see that you're saying anything more than that. If you're not careful, you get a mess, and the crystals tend to grow from one another and their mechanisms stick them together. And by the same token, you wouldn't suggest that the different formation of different crystals and dendrites and so on give us a different underlying picture of, let's say, what an ice crystal is like. I mean, the growth conditions obviously determine various things, but the underlying packing seems reasonable to assume is the same.
I think I would agree with that, but what I'm suggesting is that in contrast to the science of crystallization, which has been studied by many, many people for many, many decades, this has been studied by a handful of people for a relatively short time. Our empirical base is very scanty here.
Crystallization of polyethylene and similar things, which folds up and so folds in solution. So it doesn't seem to me that, well, I haven't heard you say anything that makes me think this should be really different. So I was just wondering whether it's something I didn't hear you say or you didn't say.
Well, I'm speculating a fair bit right here, but as I say, it does seem to me that we haven't necessarily reached those, those very slow controlled conditions where the small crystals can dissolve and the big ones and the bigger ones grow, and perhaps some fiddling around with these, with condensation in a way that we haven't done, would give more insight into that. So, passing to the ideas of self-organizing surface lattices, the picture that Yulia Rosina has developed, published a couple of years ago, emphasizes not the rod-like behavior of DNA, but rather that the surface-like behavior of DNA. That DNA is so highly charged that counterions are held within an angstrom or two, typically multivalent cations, of a surface which is certainly curved with a 10 angstrom radius of curvature, but still that to a first approximation as the two such surfaces come close together might be modeled more as a plane than as lines of zero thickness. And so the idea is that the ions are attracted to the plane, but then are free to organize themselves in a self-repelling Wigner crystal on each plane. And then when you bring two of them together, they can move around until they minimize their energy. And that, in fact, can lead to an attractive interaction. And when you work out the numbers, when Yulia worked out the numbers, what she found, taking into account the correlation energy, the lattice organization energy here, which is attractive for monovalent, divalent, and trivalent, with then the Poisson-Boltzmann energy, essentially the kinetic energy of the ions in the gap and the thermal disordering. The net is always repulsive for monovalence. Always repulsive according to this calculation for divalence, but comes pretty close to zero, and so is not necessarily in conflict with, say, the grand canonical Monte Carlo calculations of the Swedish group, which show a slight attraction, but clearly attractive for trivalence. Most of the corrections you can think of would weaken these attractions, certainly the curvature more realistic treatment of the thermal disordering. And so the one thing that is really probably most wrong about this calculation is that the energy depth, the KT per base pair here, is 1.5 KT, and that's much too strong. A more realistic estimate of the free energy of attraction per base pair in these systems is like maybe 1/100 of KT. Remember, you got 40,000 base pairs, so that adds up to a fair bit of interaction. Now, moving on to DNA stretching, first of all, just to show you that this has been published, you can fit to a worm-like chain model either inextensible or extensible, where you have some stretching forces, you get out to near full chain length. This is, as somebody nicely said, the physicist DNA. This is lambda DNA. You get very good agreement with the worm-like chain force distance prediction with a persistence length of 472 angstroms and all the good stuff. If you do it as a function of salt, you can make a nice confirmation of the Odyk and Skolnick and Fixman predictions of the long-range electrostatic effects on the persistence length, going out to about 1,000 angstroms at millimolar salt, but tailing off at sort of the high salt limit of about 500 angstroms above about 10-20 millimolar.
Is that number good for spermidine
also? No, you'll see in a second. The question is that number good for spermidine? And the answer is no, which is the interesting part of the story. Now, when you do such experiments with spermidine or hexamine cobalt, if you do them let me see what do we have here. Okay, if you when you do them with spermidine or hexamine cobalt under conditions that would collapse, would condense unstretched DNA, what you see is that at high extensions, you fit your worm-like chain model, but with, as you'll see in a minute, a reduced persistence length. But then as you shorten the DNA, so that, as we interpret it at any rate, it gets to the point where it can loop over and make side-by-side contacts with itself, then you don't go down to zero, you go to some finite force. And if you imagine pulling out on that, force times distance is an energy that we think is the energy of DNA condensation, side-by-side interaction of DNA molecules. You take that high extension part of the force curve and you plot it. Here's for hexamine cobalt. I'm going to run a little bit over, but And you see that it drops well below the so-called high salt limit for monovalent, and in fact goes down to about 300, 250 or 300 angstroms. So hexamine cobalt and spermidine are making the DNA either more flexible or introducing local bends. Persistence length is some combination of dynamic bending and dynamic flexibility and local bending. Just one more picture on this. If you have your salt high enough to compete off the condensing counter ions, then you follow this normal worm-like chain curve up pretty well. But if the added salt is low so that the condensation can occur, then you then you get this aberrant departure from worm-like chain elasticity, where things start to condense side by side, and we think that this is the picture of what's going on there. All right, let me not belabor that any longer. Let me now say a couple of things about sequences. Most of you will probably be aware that although normal DNA is so-called B-form, is a right-handed helix, it can, if it's got the proper sequence, which is an alternating purine, pyrimidine, flip over under certain conditions to a left-handed helix. And we had, that's called Z-DNA, because the backbone is zigzaggy rather than regularly helical. And we had previously shown, not really studied very much, that the same condition that seemed to provoke the B to Z transition in DNA also led to its condensation. And so we decided here to look at what would happen if we took our plasmid and stuck a little piece or two of DNA in that could undergo that B to Z flip. And indeed, we found that the more Z-forming DNA we put in, the more the condensation is measured by light scattering occurred. So we did another experiment for totally different reasons, but it turned out to be interesting. Telomeres are the ends of chromosomes. They're implicated in cellular aging. They've got interesting repeating sequences. And what we did in collaboration with Judith Berman in our Department of Plant Biology, who studies yeast chromosomes, is to take some of this repeating DNA, stick it into a plasmid, which has these restriction enzyme cutting sites. So if we cut here or here, we'd have our piece of telomeric DNA at one or another end of the DNA molecule. If we cut here or here, we'd have it in the middle. And then we asked, what is the condensability of that DNA? And the answer is that those telomere repeat sequences, wherever you put them, somewhat depress the condensability of DNA, but they do it a lot more if they're at the ends rather than at the middle. And it's been proposed theoretically that polymer collapse starts at an end rather than in the middle because it costs less entropy to wrap up one end and bring in two ends towards the middle. What may be going on there? The initial condensation is fairly rapid, actually, but then it stops. And our thought is maybe that this TRS sequence, even though it wasn't known to have any special helical properties, didn't fit with the tight helix lattice of the toroid that must be formed. Maybe you need really good close approach in order to form a stable helix. And indeed, we found by doing circular dichroism, which measures the helical parameters of DNA, that the two DNAs have a different helical properties, something that was not expected before we did this work, which sort of says something interesting to me, that DNA condensation can tell you subtle things about DNA helix conformation that you wouldn't have guessed from normal physical experiments. I will finish very briefly. A couple of remarks on effects of condensing ligands. Spherical ligands like hexamine cobalt are more effective than linear, even though they've got the same plus 3 charge. There are some effects on the size and morphology of the condensates. There are non-electrostatic interactions, hydrogen bonding and nonpolar interactions, and there are chiral selectivity. I raise this stuff. I mean, chemistry, to a physicist particularly, can get totally overwhelming. But these raise some interesting physical ideas. For example, if you take this Wigner lattice model seriously, the ions are surrounded by correlation holes, so that other trivalent cations are not very close. And so the size or geometry of those ions shouldn't matter very much. And yet, although I haven't shown you any experimental data, they do matter, not hugely, but enough to be detectable experimentally. DNA condensates as a function of dielectric constant. If you try to do mixed solvents, as I say, to test electrostatic theories, you get different morphologies as you add alcohol to lower the dielectric constant. You get more rods, and then you get fibrous things. This is pure water. This is about 10% alcohol. This is about 25% alcohol in the presence of hexamine cobalt. And you're getting the scale here is much smaller. You're getting essentially down here, you're getting fibrous. It's as if these things stick as soon as they touch. So you don't have the annealing that will allow you to form a tight, well-packed toroid. Yes, it's a network of bundles, right. What's the dielectric constant near a surface of DNA in a mixed solvent? We don't have the foggiest idea. Even in water, here's some recent molecular dynamics calculations from David Beveridge, in which the dielectric constant after about 10 angstroms goes out to the 7 or 8 angstroms out to the full water value, but close in, where the ions are doing most of their work, tails off in this sigmoidal fashion. In fact, differs whether you're in the major or minor groove. So, interesting physical thing. One last transparency. I apologize to the chair. And that is, we've also tried to take seriously the ideas of our NIH colleagues that what's going on here is not electrostatics, but hydration structure. Tried to make correlations with not only with dielectric constant, but with preferential interaction. That is, if you measure the relative amount of a co-solvent that's bound to DNA, you get a correlation with condensation. Within a, the answer is not very good for either. Within a compound, as you lower the concentration, you may, for some, but for others, you don't. And so I would say that the understanding of the effects of mixed solvents, which is, after all, how most of these experiments are done, DNAs are crystallized in 40% alcohol and high concentrations of spermine. So the DNA structures that we think we know best are crystallized at a very high condensing, dehydrating conditions. So I hope that I've given you an idea of some of the realities that need to leaven the simple physical theories that are so interesting. Thanks.